Okay, so I just had introduced myself as Gay Graham from Ireland, and I want to share with you in 15 short minutes a journey that took me almost 9 years. So bear with me, but I'm going to do it as quickly as I possibly can. That's the research question that finally got shaped as I journeyed through this whole issue. And of course, I was informed by Parker's comment that really we couldn't get any new understanding without first understanding the historic, the factors that shaped our system. So briefly, to look at our system, as I said, I'm from Ireland, so looking at the residential care system, it started with the enactment of Poor Law in 1838. But interestingly enough, though we were ruled by Great Britain at the time, the Poor Law system that was set up in Ireland was purely institutional response. There was no outdoor relief, and that significantly affected the development of residential care in the decades and generations that followed, actually. The Catholic Church then, a very strongly organised institution, saw an opportunity there, and they sort of began to prepare for possible sort of changes in the future. And only 10 years later, with the enactment of the Industrial Schools Act in 68, they saw their opportunity, because clearly that was an opportunity for them to become the major player in provision of residential care. And really for at least, you know, up until almost 1970, we had some industrial schools still existing in Ireland. And what typified then was that the separation of children from parents was pursued relentlessly. And this was something that really our society had to, you know, take on board and try to sort of recognise as we moved forward to better practice. In about 100 years, we had over 105,000 children committed by the courts to industrial schools, and very harsh care regimes prevailed. The model of care that was used there was really one that saw children as a threat to society. They prioritised the perspective of the system over that of the child. Staff were encouraged not to relate to inmates, and I deliberately use the term. That's exactly what was used in the literature of the time. Segregation and control. We had to keep these children out of society. They were a threat to society, and we had to control them tightly while we had them, and then just launch them into society again when they reached a certain age. But we know, too, from looking at models historically, that aspects of former models can outlive the model themselves. So we've moved on now, where we were totally committed to a developmental care model, where our legislation mandates us to provide developmental care for all youngsters in the care system. This requires a child welfare system that is a whole child, whole system perspective. So we're beginning to accept that really we need to think in terms of systems, but it's one thing having this sort of intellectual sort of wish to do so, but the actual operationalisation of that is still proving quite difficult. So the challenge then is to provide, as Henry Mayer said long before 2006, but I'm just referring to his paper in Leon's revised working with children with child and youth care. And it's the challenge was to provide primary care, by that we mean developmental care, in secondary or bureaucratic settings. So we were faced, we knew about this challenge for a long number of years before we even began to, I think, fully address it. What do we mean by developmental care? We all know what we mean by it. We have a shared common humanity. It requires individualised care. The individualised care only takes place in the context of reciprocal relationships. We have common needs, and as Mia Kellner-Pringle very cleverly put it in her model, love and security, new experiences, praise and recognition. So we are talking about individualised, I feel like, customised care for each young resident in our residential care system. But then the secondary setting, in other words, in the bureaucratic structure, really is typified by an impersonal, rational orientation, as Weber said, aimed at efficient administration. So that's the whole purpose and function of the bureaucratic structure. Routine tasks. Mintzberg, when he looked at this, said that it was typified by routine tasks and formalised procedures, and with a big aim, the rigidity, the rigid control was really its main aim. And of course, as such, it was actually very successful in certain contexts, but not terribly suited to provision of developmental care. And again, as Henry Mayer told us, organisational rigidity negates individuality. So now we really clearly know that we can't fit primary care in this, if it's a secondary setting construed as a bureaucratic structure. And then we look at service organisations in Certainly in our country, they're the main providers of residential youth care. They're mainly bureaucratic because they're public service organisations, public organisations. They must be seen to be fair. And this leads again to a proliferation of regulations and standardisation of tasks. Now, it's clear that needs-led care is not predictable. And in a previous piece of research that I was involved in, I showed that one of the distinguishing characteristics of residential child and youth care is its unpredictability. So clearly we cannot function and provide developmental care in this highly regulated, rigid structure. So these were the factors that really shaped my research question. And then we began to be involved in the provision to try to see how can we provide developmental care in whatever primary or secondary settings were existed at the time. And as we did this and empowered the youngsters who were there and youngsters who had left care, when they got their voice, we began to hear the stories of what happened in the previous model, where really care was not only harsh, but it was abusive. And the more we listened to this, we realised that really we must be absolutely, sort of adamant and determined to protect our children. So then child protection, instead of being an aim of our service, became the culture of the service. And that produced another problem in that everything was geared around child protection. And sometimes the operationalisation of child protection became abusive in itself almost. So we had this highly regulated sector, and practice became really... our practitioners became terribly worried about allegations being made against them. So they were quite happy to say that, to be prescribed, like prescribed practice, and be told this is what you do, you do particular things in specific circumstances. And they were robotic in their whole approach to their young people. And clearly this was not a way to provide developmental care. And informed decision making was something that was rarely, it wasn't expected, and it certainly wasn't encouraged in frontline practice. And without informed decision making, how can we individualise and respond to the needs of our youngsters? So clearly, if the structure of the service was not facilitating developmental care, what needed to be done? So then I decided that really I felt we knew what we wanted to do. We knew what the barriers, some of the barriers to provision of it. So I took a sort of an organisational perspective on this and decided to look at residential care as being provided at that time from the perspective of frontline managers, their line managers and the CEOs of residential services. So I sort of had this interesting methodology, which I'm not going to discuss today, but it yielded 18 respondents in total, and it was a nationwide sample. I had 8 services represented in that, and interestingly enough, the analysis showed that 6 of those services were hitting most of the buttons. They had good potential. Some of them were actually providing developmental care. Most of them were hitting a lot of the buttons. So they were actually, and I will talk to you about the themes that emerged that indicated this. And then there were 2 services that just were not hitting any of the buttons. So it became very clear and very strong. So the analysis, having had so much data that I thought I'd never get through, it did eventually show to be, it became quite clear. So the services that were still operating from a social risk model, what the themes that typified those services were prioritisation of compliance in frontline practice, not needs-led care as mandated in the legislation. There was a presence still of a traditional view of residential care as merely child-minding. And this view was largely held by senior management in particular, but they made all the decisions. Strategic planning and development of frontline services were seen as exclusive responsibilities of senior management. So that's what typified what we were referring to as the themes of the social risk model. Whereas the themes that emerged from the developmental services were that the workforce factors were managed by directors of frontline services with domain expertise. That became very, very important. Our inspector, very quickly when they started inspecting services in Ireland, insisted that all frontline managers would have domain expertise, but didn't look beyond that. So the people that the frontline managers reported to, it was almost more important that they had domain expertise as well as sound leadership abilities and all of the rest. Directors of service had leadership skills that ensured commitment by all frontline staff to provision of needs-led care by clarifying the purpose of residential care as developmental care for residents. As provision of development care. And strategic planning and development in these services were practice-led. So quite distinctly different. So when you juxtapose these 2 sets of themes, it became quite easy to see then, what critical success factors need to be there to ensure that we're providing the developmental care that we the model that we subscribe to. So just I'll go quickly through the factors because I didn't get my 3 minutes warning yet. No, okay, sorry, I'm not inviting it. okay. But just that, you know. So provision then of developmental care and residential child and youth care, I say to people who understand that totally here in this audience, requires reciprocal relationships which are needs-led, not regulation-led. And it was interesting this morning in some of the presentations that I listened to said, you know, don't let's be all the time worried about what the outside regulatory bodies, let's get our act together where we are in the frontline service first. The senior manager, that would be a director of service level tasked with responsibility for the workforce in the residential youth care sector, must have authority and domain expertise. Now, this became very, very clear. And by authority, I mean that person is the budget holder. So that person is a senior person in a situation where he or she is given the budget for the residential service, and that could include up to 20 units of different levels of high support, special care, and, you know, sort of mainstream care, though we're now separating out special care in the Irish context, which I think is not necessarily a positive step, but that's another argument. But they must have this, and they must be held totally accountable for provision of developmental care. And they take that responsibility and obviously ensure that the factors in place in the front line facilitate that. It's necessary to have accountable leadership with authority and developmental care expertise or understanding. And this develops then a committed commitment to a shared vision about the purpose of residential child and youth care, which is the provision of developmental care. So the whole lot is designed around this primary aim. Strategic planning and service development in residential youth care services needs to be practice-led and guided by a shared vision of developmental care and ongoing evaluation around that. And then finally, the final factor is responsibility of a duty of care mandated by the legislation must be prioritised over that of bureaucratic inputs in services. So concluding comments then would be that provision of developmental care in organisational settings and secondary settings, if you like, is possible when the design of those settings is such that it allows practitioners to exercise discretion to participate in decisions affecting their work and influence the pace of their work. So they're given certain control over their work. And the self-contained task structure from an organisational design structure well accepted in commercial enterprises, that actually can provide an environment suited to the provision of developmental care, provided it is well protected from senior bureaucratic decisions taken at the more senior level, if you have that competent director of service who can ensure that what happens beneath him is totally focused on the provision of developmental care. So that's my contribution.
Good workers often get promoted to things that aren't direct care.
Yes.
Do you have things built in that keep good people where they are?
No, we don't contrive to do that. But I think it's a very healthy development if people who have been involved in frontline go right up through the system, because they're informing practice at broader levels and informing our bureaucrats what actually needs to be done and how resources need to be used. So we don't contrive. We don't in any way try to keep people on the ground floor. I think it's healthy that they move in some ways. But we do protect them and develop them while they're there, hopefully. Okay. Thank you very much.